the energy we use, and it has to be imported. And we've got to be nice with everybody in the world to make sure that they continue to treat us correctly. Otherwise, we're not going to get our oil, and we're going to be sitting on gas lines again. To have that vulnerability and to accept that, I don't understand that. Even if it's a non-ideal solution, we've got to start working on that solution. As I said before, the first step begins on with the longest journey begins with the first step. And we're not really beginning the journey by my standards. Hey, Paul, I hope some nice, pleasant things are happening in space. WS2N, hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz. K2RIW, drive with the space report, Paul.
No, you didn't put me to sleep. This is WS2N. I saw that show on Nova about the sun. Very good, Dick. Very well done. Yeah, I just wanted to mention the Dragon and Falcon, Dragon spacecraft and the Falcon 9 launcher that we've talked about many weeks on the net. We're supposed to go up tomorrow, but they're going to delay it. The SpaceX is requesting a week's delay. They want to fine-tune a few different calibrations and want to make sure everything's right before they launch to go up to the International Space Station with 1,200 pounds of cargo, and then bring back 1,200 pounds of scientific experiments that the launcher will bring back. So that will be 1 week, not tomorrow, but the following Monday. I don't have the new launch time. Yesterday's launch time would have been 12:22. Tomorrow's launch time would have been 12:22, but I don't know what we're going to see next. We'll have to find that out. You brought up the gate system that the corporation is going to have to develop in case there's a problem. So I looked into that. And the launcher board system is what they call it. Apollo had a thing called a tractor set up. So did Mercury. They had a like tower attached to the top of the spacecraft. And if there was a problem, they would light solid rockets with it, and it would just pull the spacecraft away from the main rocket, and then that would separate from the capsule, and the capsule would have the parachutes open up, and it would come down on land. That's the way it was designed, and they wanted SpaceX to do something similar or come up with their own idea. They came up with, instead of a tractor type, you know, it was pulling the spacecraft away, they came up with what they call a push-up motor rocket. So it's designed like in the bottom of the spacecraft, the capsule part. So there's no tower sticking out of the top, no solids on top holding it away and dropping it. But, you know, they have these rockets, you know, blended in with the spacecraft itself. Very aerodynamic type of design where you don't really see these things unless they go off, you know, and they'll pull the, instead of pulling it, they'll push the Dragon spacecraft away from the Falcon 9 rocket in case there's a problem. Now, this is not really necessary for next week's flight, but it will be for the manned flight that eventually come up. Spacecraft Dragon will be convertible. We'll be able to go from a cargo vehicle to a manned spacecraft. The board system that you were asking about last week, what they came up with, looks pretty good. NASA approved it. So I thought I'd bring that up and drop it. And I wanted to talk about, oh, by the way, that's a 21-day mission. Initially, I said 8 days. That's what they were thinking about. But it is a 21-day mission. It's going to be attached to the space station twice at a time. aboard, the scientists really like this. Right now, there's no way of bringing anything back. They want to bring back people and a few little things in it. And the Soyuz spacecraft, there's no way to bring back, you know, large amounts of cargo, which the scientists would like to have. This spacecraft will be able to... I want to bring up the, so it's a 21-day mission. Cargo, the cargo that's coming down, I mean, they put all junk in the, but they don't need the other spacecraft. This one they'll bring, be able to bring back the, you know, real scientific stuff. Drop it.
Yeah, one of the things I'm very interested in, Paul, is that 1,200 pounds of cargo is going up. Roughly 1,200 pounds is coming back. How is the 1,200 pounds coming back? Is that going to be landing on parachute? And is that parachute over land or over water? Over to you, John. I mean, Paul.
Yeah, the spacecraft comes down to the orbit and lands in the Pacific right now. So they've done this already. They're dragging up for two orbits. Land is exactly where they wanted to bring the ship out there and just get picked it up. No problem. So that's what they're going to do. In the future, it will be landing on land with people eventually. So, they've really come a long way. I just want to mention Curiosity is like only 100 days away from landing on Mars. We watch that thing take off in November, and it will be landing August 5th. Looks like nighttime, late nighttime on August 5th. Looking forward to that. We talk about that a lot. We'll talk about it a lot in 3 months from now, I'm sure. And that's pretty much it. I just want to bring up the Dragon flight. Curiosity and launch board system. I'm talking about bringing people back. The expedition 30 has returned from the ISS and landed in Kazakhstan the other day. We landed last Friday with 3 astronauts back, 1 American, 2 Russians. And it's interesting, if you ever watch these things come down, you know, they come back down on parachutes, they do land on land, and they have a crew of people pulling people out of the it looks like some job to get them out of the spacecraft. One at a time, drop it. And they have 3 chairs sitting there out in the field. The stuff is all boarded by helicopter right before they land. They have these fancy like lawn chairs sitting out there, and they put each guy in one. They carry him from the spacecraft. They can't walk. They've been up there for 3 months. So, you know, no ability of really walking. And after putting them in the chairs, they throw a big blanket on them, and then they pick them up. I mean, half a dozen guys pick up each astronaut, and they bring them over to a big red tent, and they change out. Eventually, they get to the helicopter, and they fly over to Star City, Moscow, and the Russians go there, and the Americans, NASA has a plane ready for him. They take him back to Houston. So. That's the way they come back. No fancy shuttle, that's for sure. Back to you, Dick. WS.
I think you're saying there are 3 astronauts left on the International Space Station. 3 came home in the Soyuz by parachute, landed over land. I think it's in Kazakhstan. When the Falcon, Dragon, SpaceX craft stops transmitting only, transporting only cargo, and it really transports astronauts, on the way up, I think we know what's going to happen, but I think you said on the way down, they're going to be landing with a retro rocket over land. My goodness, that strikes me kind of dangerous. Unless you've got an escape tower. You talked about an escape mechanism. But any of those rockets on the landing sequence pick up, boy, it gets very uncomfortable real fast. Will they be landing over water, or will the astronauts coming back down by SpaceX land by parachute at in the water at first? Or do you think the very first time astronauts on board, they'll be landing on land? And are you sure it's going to be retro rocket and not parachute? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah. If you read it, they say it's going to be retro rockets, but I think that's a long way off. Right now, they're coming back with parachutes and landing in the Pacific. Eventually, they'll be landing on land. My guess with parachutes and right at the very end, they fire these retro rockets, similar to what the Russians do. Just at the very end, just to really soften the blow and into the ground. That's the way I think it's going to work. I'm still a long way off. Yeah, but they, you know, you read the website, in fact, if you look at the animation, that's the way it looks. It's kind of retro, retros all the way down. I don't know. I mean, they do have the pusher rockets that I was going to talk about earlier. If they get a problem, they get a ground rocket lifted up to the air and then parachute the pop out. That's the plan there.
Okay. Make a rough guess, Paul. When will the first human being be on board these new craft?
I'm going 2 years from now, probably mid. I'm going to go mid 2014, and that'll be the first test flight, by the way, of the Orion spacecraft. Around that time, probably. No, not a full-up launch. Not working on that. Space shots. We've got this space launch system, space launch system, that's all that's before. And that's bigger than the Apollo 5 rocket man. They'll eventually put an Orion on top of that. You won't see that until probably 2017, according to what I listened to. NASA Administrator Charles Baldwin and that was his report.
At one time, the International Space Station was predicted to be usable up until the year 2020. I think that's the year that they originally proposed. It's likely that that's going to be extended. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, there's no reason they can't run that for, you know, 20, 30 years. Initially, they said, 15 years? But, I mean, some components have been up. They started, 1999? So, you know, based on that theory, Zarya, that's the functioning cargo block, that's the first section that was put up there and made it to the American Unity node in 1999. I mean, you're looking at 13 years already. I mean, based on that 15-year theory, you got two more years left. That ain't going to happen. I think that you'll cruise on that thing for the next 20 years.
I'm with you, Paul, and thank you for the report. John, what makes you think that you're in trouble with that directional coupler? Those pictures you mailed me, I can tell by the couple of words you put in that memo and the pictures of your directional coupler, all apart on your workbench. The couple of words you said there made me think that you think it's the end of the world just because there's a broken portion of the termination. In my opinion, there's no great magic there. That is very fixable, I think. So, am I misinterpreting that, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
That was a jovial statement, Dick. I just put that in there because it was so frustrating. As you see, I showed you a couple of setups in those photos. And by the way, they are at Bernie's at Huntfamily.net. at Bernie@HuntFamily.com. What I did was I was working with that directional coupler, and I fed a signal into it, and I was watching the output port on my spectrum analyzer. And no matter what I did on the end, whether it was short, open, or what, the signal didn't change. So I started a real thorough investigation before I opened it. I've had these couplers open many times. And the thing I did not do is I did not take an ohmmeric reading right away from the output port and ground, which are most couplers. It should be as short as it was. And what had happened, as you can see there, that's an aluminum rod, and it's broken. Very difficult to fix. But I also realized how NARTA changed the coupling coefficient of the couplers. That was something I learned I did not realize that before. But you saw the photographs, you see the problem. And there's some cracks in what looks like a ferrite coating on that output port rod.
Yeah, many of the output port rods really have a 50 ohm termination, internal or external. And when you put your ohmmeter on there, you measure 50 ohms. On this particular one, where the rod looks like it goes all the way through that ferrite absorber and then into the rod touching ground, it looks like it could be 0 ohms, although it doesn't have to touch ground. It's a ceramic lossy material. It's sufficiently lossy at the frequencies you care about. Whether or not the far end is grounded becomes irrelevant. That could be, and the fact that the ceramic is chipped isn't necessarily bad. If it's chipped and there's a whole lot of pieces floating around inside, that's not so good. But the chipping could have been the tuning process. What that ferrite rod is trying to do is, across the frequencies of interest, act like a pure 50-ohm load where all signals go into it, get absorbed, and nothing gets reflected back out. And even if it is imperfect, you probably, if you had a chance to read far enough in that article I recommended you read that's on the Roadrunners Microwave Group page, there's ways you can recalibrate your directional coupler. Now, yes, you've got an intermittent in yours, and as you tapped on it, my guess is it jumped up and down. And that broken piece, do you think that that's been thrown onto a concrete floor? Which is, by the way, one of the things that I mentioned in that article. Back to you for any discussion on any of the above, Paul. But the KC2WGB, K2LIW. I meant John. I'm sorry about that. You got it, John.
Okay, Dick, I was just waiting for the beep. Yeah, that is the direct short to ground. There's a little pin, as you can see, where it slides onto. In this particular coupler, that's how that is done. So now, the tuning, which I'd never realized, on the input and output port, if you look at the end connector, the female part, which is the female part, if you take a pair of long-nosed pliers and you grab that rod and rotate it, you change those vanes inside the coupler. I don't know if you looked at those switched areas on the piece. They become adjacent when it's mounted properly.
Yes, I did see those vanes. And you're speculating, you might be right, that as they rotate that main straight through rod, that that is a tuning mechanism by which they adjust coupling, flatness, or whatever, or directivity. I'm not so convinced. I think there's a desired way that they set that up. You can tell by the way the aluminum major outer piece is hugged out just right. I think the stepping of that center conductor and the stepping of the directional line, I think those steps match each other. And I don't think they twist one versus the other. If they do, I think they do it very little. And I'm having trouble with that twist because depending on the way some people screw in a type N connector, they could be creating an inadvertent twist of that center conductor. I mean, the right way to put together SMA or type N connectors is to turn only the outer threaded barrel, not to turn the whole Don object. When people put terminations on connectors, they usually rotate the whole Don thing, which is very not recommended, because now the center pin, the male and female center pin where they come together, as that rotation takes place, you're grinding metal parts in there. You're scraping away the silver plating or the gold plating, and you're generating little metal pieces. It's really not recommended. So I don't think that that's intended to be rotated as a tuning mechanism, and I don't think that's required, John. So when you tried to measure its directivity, you got crazy numbers because of that break. But even though it's an aluminum rod, I guarantee that that's fixable, John. KC2, WGB, K2LIW.
Trying to solder aluminum, and it is quite difficult. Copper to aluminum is a little easier than aluminum to aluminum. I know you can heliarc, which can't be done in this case, and there are some other methods. I was also looking, asking a friend of mine about contact, sort of like spot welding, which might be able to be done. But looking at it carefully, if those veins are not required, I could replace that with approximately a number 10 wire. I didn't mic it up perfect, but it looks like a number 10 wire. And I think I could even flatten the end out, drill it, and mount it in the end. But I don't know if I can slip that ferrite off of it. It looks like it's on there pretty good.
It may only be glued in there, John, and with the right kind of solvent, you can dissolve that glue. And it's not as critical as you think. A distributed attenuator is a very easy thing to do. In other words, you don't have to have a great deal of exactness. If it's got the right number of wavelengths of length, it'll eventually be lossy enough, if you know what I mean. That really is a distributed attenuator. And if you made the attenuator, let me pick a number, 30 dB, of insertion loss one way, then by the time the signal gets down to the pin that's the short circuit at the end and reflects back and has another 30 dB of attenuation, you've got a 60 dB reflection coefficient, which in my mind is an extremely good termination, if you know what I mean. So it's only got to be lossy in one direction. It doesn't have to be perfectly matched at exactly 50 ohms along the whole length. You get away with a lot of murder when you're building an attenuator, a distributed attenuator. And those rods are silver plated, John. I think you can solder plate to the silver plating. It won't be completely strong, but there's various ways you can put a little piece of Teflon in there to support it. And even if you have a blob of solder in the area where you solder the two rods together, that's going to be an extremely minor perturbation to the directivity and the coupling coefficient. Very minor. You probably think that you've got to make everything here, optically smooth to the nearest 20th of a wavelength of light. Nowhere near. You can get away with murder on this thing, John. You can even make yourself a male and female pin that you put in there that holds them together mechanically, and you're going to get 99% of the performance. It's not that critical, even though you think it is, John. KC2 WGB, K2LIW.
Great idea, Dick, because what I was thinking of doing is taking something like remember when ballpoint pens used to have an ink column that was in a brass tube? I have a brass tube that will slip over the left side, circular side, the round side, and maybe I could have that tapered down into a pin that I could insert into the that square little block that it came off of. That's possible. That should not change it in any appreciable way, I would assume. And the reason I took those pictures, a lot of people have never seen the inside of a cup, or they don't know what the hell's going on in there, and it really is a very basic and simple thing. So I thought you'd enjoy those.
Absolutely. Another thing you can do with those two ends you're trying to bring together, John, you could buy an 080 tap. You could put a double-ended 080 screw, if it's a male on both ends, cut off the head and solder it and file it down just nice. You could make an 080 screw by tapping each end with 080, if there's enough meat there, and I think there might be, and then you can bring them together with a screw thread. It doesn't even have to be perfectly soldered or welded. And maybe 080 is too big, and maybe you got to go to the next size smaller screw, but mechanically you can bring that together, John, and then do a little bit of local support so that the next time it gets dropped, it doesn't break again. My guess is somebody threw that down onto a concrete floor. What do you think, John? K2RIW?
Dick, the last time I used that was about a year ago, and it was working. There's not a nick on the frame, but obviously it was dropped maybe one of the grandchildren. I don't remember dropping it myself. It's basically on the bench, but something happened to it for sure. It's not a very rigid structure inside when it's taken apart, but also the length has to be exactly, the exact length has to be there, because if it's not, it'll offset the center pin of the end connector. Maybe the length would work, you know, an eighth of an inch RF-wise would make a difference, but it will sure offset the center pin of the F connector, the end connector, and that would make it useless.
Okay, maybe I'm misunderstanding. The break that I saw was the break between the long, lossy termination rod and the pickup coil for the coupling port. And that makes a right angle bend, and then it comes out to a tight end connector, the coupled port. The straight through portion, I think, was undamaged, but maybe I'm wrong on that. I think the straight through portion, all you've got to do is just reinstall it and screw everything down again. So I think there's only one break, and that is the terminated end of the coupled line has a break. Am I wrong on that one, John? Go ahead.
You're absolutely right, Dick. The straight through, the input port to the output port is one contiguous piece, no problem. It's the L bend that goes up to the output port from the pickup rod. It is the pickup rod that's broken approximately in the center.
And as you make that section longer or shorter where you put it back together, that's going to make only a little bit of a tilt to where the type end connector comes out. That's not going to change the length of the center pin. And by the way, a type end connector is rather forgiving. I've seen people do a homebrew installation of a type end connector on the end of a cable where they do a poor job and the center pin is sticking out 15 thou too much or 15 thou too little. Most of the time, it continues to work like a charm, John. It's not that critical. You got some play in there, if you know what I mean. This is not watchmaker maker work, and particularly if you're doing it under a microscope, and I think you own a good stereo zoom microscope, I'm pretty sure you can mechanically put this thing together, and it doesn't have to be perfect. The RF is slightly blind when it comes to the fine details that your eye is going to see under that microscope, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, what I was pointing out is, as that rod, if you look at the picture, as that rod gets a little bit longer, any length change at all, it's going to put the center pin of the end connector off-center at the sampling port. That has to be directly held perfectly in place, which it is by those Teflon bushings that you see in the picture. But it would have to be really right on the money.
Not as much as you think, John. If I have a air-type coaxial cable where I've got some kind of a metallic structure that represents the outer conductor, and I got a rod down the center representing the center conductor, and I got, let's say, air in between, and I start taking that center conductor and drifting it off to one side so it's closer to the outer conductor, you'll be amazed how far that's got to be drifted away from center before the characteristic impedance changes a whole lot.
I'm talking about the mechanics, Dick. The pin won't find it.
Okay. Isn't the center pin, that is the directional coupler output port, that center pin, isn't that continuously connected to the rod that goes down, makes the right angle bend, and then becomes the coupling section? Go ahead.
Yes, it is. And as you make the coupling section longer, even a hair longer, it's going to offset that pin because that's coming up vertically. If you had the output port straight up toward the ceiling, it will move it more to the right, and that'll keep the pin from making contact.
Okay, but I think as you put it together, if it requires a little bit more bending here and there and a little bit of English to make everything come out right, I think you can handle that, John. And the fact that that ceramic black attenuator material has a discontinuous section to it where it looks like something chopped out a piece, that could have been a tuning mechanism that they built at the factory. And Nardo, by the way, is in the, what's the name of the town there? Farmingdale? No. But it's at exit 50 of the, no, exit 48 or so of the expressway. Anyhow, when you took it apart, were there black ceramic pieces floating around inside like they had broken off? And if the answer is no, and you've got a missing piece, I think that was a turning mechanism. Over to you, John.
There was one, Dick, and I think it was Plainview, Long Island.
Okay. It's now east of me. Why can't I think of the name of that town? I used to work there. It's Hop Hog. They're in Hop Hog right now. They've moved. They've been there for a good number of years in Hop Hog. I visited that place a couple of times. Some of the IEEE meetings are held there. I can't think of that. I think it's Moorland Drive in Hop Hog. Anyhow, the that piece that broke off, that you found floating around inside, for you to glue it back on, no sweat. Don't worry about that. Now, the way the ceramic works, it doesn't have to make perfect contact across the broken edge, if you know what I mean. You can glue it back in place. You'll be amazed how forgiving this thing is, John. And even if it used to have 29 dB of directivity, and after all of this breaking and fixing and everything else, it has 24 dB of directivity and still has 10 dB of coupling coefficient. You're in like Flynn for what you're going to do, because there's ways you can calibrate it, make it better, or use the data you get out of it and correct the data. When you read deep enough into that article, you'll find ways of correcting the imperfections of your particular directional coupler. It doesn't have to be perfect. The directional couplers that are built into almost every one of the modern-day vector network analyzer only have mediocre performance. The calibration procedure equations takes it all back out, if you know what I mean. And you can do the same thing. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
They can get away with the less proper coupler because of that 12-step program and the calibration.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Let me ask you something, Dick. Can it be worked on with the plate removed and make tests? Or would you... Do I have to have that second plate on it to examine it for its functionality?
Oh, absolutely. That plate's got to be there, John. The upper plate and the lower plate is what really generates the 50-ohm Z0 of any of those lines. You take away the upper plate, and instead of it being a 50-ohm line, it's going to be a 90-ohm line, if you know what I mean. Now, you've got to hold it together in order to test it. You've got to put the two plates together and sort of screw them down so that they make reasonable contact top to bottom in the area that you care about. So it's very equivalent to the strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier, which has a top cover, and people wanted to run the amplifier without the top cover at the kilowatt level. For two reasons you can't do that. Number one, it's radio biohazard, and number two, it won't tune anymore. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, well, I thought I'd ask, but I pretty much knew it had to be on there. It would make it a lot easier if I could do it that way. But, yeah, I'm going to have to look into getting that rod connected somehow. And, you know, I was looking around, and this is the only 10 dB one I have. So I could work with other ones, but this is exactly what fits in the articles. Very well written. I like the article. I wound up reading most of those articles. There's quite a few of them there. But this one is very interesting. And I actually set up to do the full experiment, and I was starting to do it. And I got so frustrated, I put a spectrum analyzer on the output, and I put the spectrum analyzer on the sampling port, and I had the other spectrum analyzer on the input port. And I saw the in and out was fine, and everything worked perfectly, but not that output port. I knew there was something wrong there. First, I thought it was me, but after a long the experiment, I just knew it was a couple of...
Now, the article may have led you astray, John. There is nothing magic about a 10 dB coupler, just that the mathematics works out a little bit easier. And because you're using the coupler at some other frequency, your 10 dB coupler is no longer a 10 dB coupler. If you started off with a 20 dB coupler, or a 30 dB coupler, or a 16 dB coupler, once you understand the mathematics, it'll work like a charm for what you're trying to do. There's nothing magic about 10. I think any of your other couplers, as long as you're using them at a frequency lower than their design frequency, that article will let you do it. Nothing magic about 10, John. Go ahead.
Okay, I just thought it would be easier on the math end. I'd like to stick with one coupler, and if I could use the one that's written about, you know, that I can follow it exactly. But if I had another one of these couplers, which I thought I did, but I tore the place apart, I can't find one. So I may have to move on to something else. But I thought you'd like to see the inside of this. Very well, nice machine work there. It's pretty heavy for the size of this thing. It's got a lot of mass to it.
What was your first clue that something was wrong? You tapped on it and saw the coupling cord go up and down, or the coupling cord was giving you an amount of signal that was crazy or too small? What was the first clue that something was wrong, John?
Well, Dick, if it was a question of tap on it and saw a change, I would think I had a bad connector or something like that. No, it didn't do that. I just, no matter what I did, at the output, if you see some of the setups, no matter what load I put on there, nothing would change on that output. It was giving me basically the same signal. I would see it drop, you know, a hair, maybe the width of the line would go up, but nothing definitive. And that's when I realized that absolutely something's wrong. First I thought I had a bad cable going to the spectrum analyzer. Then I thought maybe the pin wasn't making a connection. So I tried all different types of things, spent a lot of time on it. And I just said, well, coupler's bad. Then I started to take it apart. Something I didn't want to do, but like I say, there's only three items altogether there. So it's a pretty easy job.
Yeah, now that I think about it, with that broken section, which was a complete open circuit, and I guess those two pieces were not making any contact, if you had tapped it in one particular direction so they made contact, you would have seen something change. With that complete open circuit, essentially all directivity disappears. Now when you put a short circuit, an open circuit, or a 50-ohm load on the output, in all three cases, you're going to measure an amount of signal on the coupled port that is almost constant in amplitude. And I think that's what you saw. Very little change no matter what you used as a load. Is that true?
Exactly right, Dick. It didn't change at all. I mean, I even got so frustrated, I took the output port and I took a screwdriver, I shorted the center pin right to the ferrule and made sure that was a dead short. Because I thought maybe my short wasn't working. I thought I should see something, but absolutely no change. And that's what led me to believe that the output, something happened there. Either the end connector broke off on the inside or whatever. On the beam and run.
N2XJN.
Okay, that was a good piece of research as I see it, John. And this is a very educational process. You're learning now about how directional couplers work, where the directivity comes from, what quality of dummy load is required, and anything in the vicinity of a 50-ohm dummy load will make it work. You had a complete open circuit there. So instead of 50 ohms, you had 10 million ohms, if you know what I mean, just a little bit of capacitive coupling. And so that's really bad. So 50 ohms, if it turns out to be 48 or 52, it'll work. Yeah, even if it turns out to be 37, it'll work and you can recalibrate. Just so you'll have fairly poor directivity and therefore the amount of compensation you got to do will increase.
Now, I'll tell you another part of the story.
Go ahead with the other part.
So I set my generator up to feed a specific signal to the input port. And as I got into this, I said, okay, let me get the spectrum analyzers out of here. I took my Boomtun RF millivoltmeter, and I started measuring voltages. I just got it back that day from the calibration lab. It was just returned to me. I'm measuring voltages that are way over what they're supposed to be, according to my generator. So I said, well, maybe the generator, Gigatron, maybe something wrong with that. So I put the HP on it, and same thing. I called up the calibration lab. I read them the Riot Act. So they said they were going to send me a label, shipping label. They send it right back. And, you know, there'd be no charge on it. I forgot to put the 50-ohm load on the probe, Dick. I had to call them up and apologize profusely. I thought you'd enjoy that.
I see. You hadn't mailed it yet back, I hope. Is that true?
No, I did not. This took, all took place in the same day. But they were right on the stick. You know, they were going to take care of it. And they were very upset about it, but I called them back. They're great guys.
Now, I think I've told you once before, John, I am convinced that you are much too conservative on this one. You treat every one of your pieces of test equipment with tender, loving care. You're not loaning them out to 40 other people. You're not bouncing them on the concrete floor. You're not hitting them with a sledgehammer. Even though each of those instruments have a recommended calibration, recalibration time to them. And if you're running a production laboratory and you're shipping equipment under a government contract, yes, you have to confirm calibration. But for your particular operation, for the number of dollars you're putting into calibration, I don't think you've got to do it. I think you could cut your calibration down by a 4-to-1 ratio, and it would be good enough. The main vector network analyzer that I use every single day, thank goodness I'm not supplying production final test equipment. I'm doing research and development. It was last calibrated in 2004, and we haven't turned it off since, and it's giving us beautiful performance. Because we've discovered that when it comes to the research and development equipment, every time we send it out for calibration, it comes back in worse condition than it went out in our particular case. Yours, but maybe not. You're going to a good house. As such, we're way ahead of the game to not calibrate if it's not absolutely required. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
K2QAQ with a comment?
You're probably right, Dick. But, you know, I bubble wrap this stuff, and they do a good job, too. The thing that frustrates me the most, I give them specific orders not to put the calibration stickers on the front of the instruments. I want them on the back or on the bottom. But they're so used to putting them on the front because mostly everything's rack mounted, and, you know, the inspectors want to see it that way. And I have trouble with them doing that. But I don't send all of the stuff out, just specific instruments. In fact, I have two generators, a Rode and an HP, that are out in calibration right now. And I use those to check the other ones that I have, which don't go out for calibration. So as long as I can get it close, pick it up, Dick, and hand it up to Glenn.
How often are you shipping equipment to a customer that demands calibration, John? Go ahead.
Embarrassing answer. I don't do it anymore. Used to.
Just because you're used to doing all that calibration, I think you're spending quite a bit more money than you have to, but that's just my opinion. Let's see what Glenn's got to say on this one. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, actually, when it comes down to stuff like that, a lot of times, I've picked up a lot of test equipment over the years, and you know, unfortunately, I don't use it as often as I'd like to, but one of the other things I've also invested in over the years is picking up some standards. You know, whenever I find them or come across them, I try to pick them up because it's always nice to have little reference standard things to basically just always check things against occasionally and just to see if they're, you know, if anything's drifted or anything's gone wrong. And you'd be amazed at how often everything's just spot on. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
See, the standards have to go out.
In the case of a vector network analyzer, where your standard is a short, open, and 50-ohm termination, and you've got all three of those in both the male polarity and the female polarity, as long as nobody is throwing them on the floor, and as long as you once in a blue moon put a digital voltmeter from center pin to ground, and you see 49.99 ohms or 50.01 ohms, that's good enough. I mean, how much accuracy do you really need? Do we really have to make our measurements as ham radio operators good to the third decimal place traceable to the National Bureau of Standards? I don't think so. And so I'd much rather see you invest your money in new test equipment rather than continuously supply the funding that allows the calibration laboratory guy who runs the laboratory to keep going out on his new sailboat, and he buys a bigger one each year. I don't think that's required. but that's an opinion. And so you're a lot more exacting guy than I am, John. KC2 WGB, KTRIW.
JN.
All right, Dick, I'll let it drop because I think Wesley wants to talk about something. KC2 WGB. Thank you, Dick.
You've got it, Wes.
I would like to hear something from you guys, Glenn and Dick. Obviously, you have made a statement that energy is being stored in the vacuum. Could you support that statement with a proper explanation? Because so far, for some reason, it looks like you tried to meet the answer to your statement and to its field.
Can I take that one, Dick?
Yeah, I'm going to admit ahead of time that I don't think I know a simple explanation for how a vacuum can store energy. But I believe it's doing it. Over to you, Glenn.
My best way of explaining this one to you, Wesley, is think of energy as something that's displaced. I know in electronics we use the word stored, because when we talk about stored, we're always talking about a confined amount of energy in a certain volume and area. And we say, okay, this is what's stored in this particular area. But when you're talking about a volume of pure vacuum, which is vacuum in an open space, energy doesn't really require any kind of a mass to be around it to exist. If you look at all the equations in all your science books, you'll see energy is treated separately from mass. But see, the interesting thing is when we do our calculations, we put them together so that we can quantify it and come up with actual values for that interreaction between mass and energy. But energy exists on its own. And when you're talking about things such as vacuum, the energy, when it's in free, open vacuum space, it's basically just, I know we're using that word stored, it's displaced is the best way of putting it. It's just taking up an area that has no mass inside of it. So energy, yes, can exist. And there again, any kind of work or, measurement of that energy requires some mass to get in its way. But basically, energy doesn't require mass, Wesley. That's my best way of explaining it to you. It's a separate entity, KC2QIQ.
Let me add to that one, Glenn. If I've got a cavity resonator, I've got a six-sided cavity made out of silver-plated materials, and I inject a signal in there, and the signal is bouncing back and forth. In the cavity that I'm likely to use in my room, it's filled with air. But I could, if I want to, put that cavity inside of a vacuum bell jar, and I would get almost the exact same result. So I can put radio energy at the resonant frequency inside of my cavity resonator, which has got nothing but a pure vacuum and a six-sided wall made out of silver-plated materials. Energy is there. Energy is in that vacuum. I think you're going to say, and maybe Wesley's going to say, the energy is there because it is moving. It is bouncing back and forth between the walls. Is the energy really sitting stagnant? Well, the energy we're talking about, if I put a sampling probe in there into a very fast sampling oscilloscope, I will confirm that there is a sine wave of RF energy at the resonant frequency inside of that cavity resonator. Now, a person will say that, hey, it's bouncing off the walls, it's moving. Another person will say it is a standing wave, it is not moving, it is not propagating, but yet it's got a sinusoidal waveform to it. So is that energy stored in the vacuum of that vacuum chamber that I'm now describing, this cavity resonator? And if so, Wes is going to again ask us a question at the molecular level. Since the vacuum consists of nothing, how is it being stored? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
See, that's actually the whole point, is that energy, when we're using the word stored always in electronics, as we're saying, okay, energy is stored in a capacitor, and we're always dealing with some kind of mass at that point in time. But energy, in its natural state in a vacuum, is just displaced. It's basically just taking up an area, completely void of any kind of a mass. So energy doesn't require mass to exist. It's just a, you know, it's just energy. And here again, it doesn't have to be a sine wave. I mean, yes, it's true. It could be a sine wave with angular rotation in a vacuum at a frequency, but it could also just be charge. You know, it could just basically be a voltage across two points, and you can move those plates further and further apart in a vacuum, and that energy is just displaced across that area, and with no mass in between. KC2, QIQ.
Should they? John recognized that I got a quick question first, and that is, you said that a capacitor has mass. Now, any real capacitor I pick up, yeah, the positive plate is made out of metal and it's got some mass, the negative plate's made out of metal, it's got some mass, and the wires that connect to them have got some mass. In theory, I could make the sheet metal of each of those plates thinner and thinner and thinner. In theory, I could make the wire going to the plates smaller and smaller in diameter. I can make the apparent physical mass of that capacitor approach zero without changing its capacitance. So, does a capacitor have to have mass in order to be a capacitor? Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, it actually does, Dick, because you have to have the plates. You know, I mean, certainly the energy doesn't require mass, but it's displaced between the plates. But to be a capacitor, by definition, you have to have the plates.
I can make those plates approach zero mass. I can't get all the way there. I'll admit that. You got it, John.
Dick, if we took a thermometer out into space and we took the shade off the bulb, the sun's energy would raise the temperature of that thermometer, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. But now you've got to ask the question, what is the thermometer measuring? Under normal circumstances, a thermometer measures this thing we call temperature. And I can call temperature, I can use two different explanations for temperature. Normally, I bathe that thermometer in some kind of a fluid. The fluid could be a pot of water, or it could be a pail of air. The fluid is the air. But normally, I put the thermometer in some kind of a fluid, or maybe I bury it under the soil and I want to measure the temperature of the soil, or I put it in very good contact with a piece of metal and I want to measure the temperature of the metal. But in all of those cases, the thermometer, the glass bulb of the thermometer, acquires the temperature of the substance it is touching, and the substance it's touching has a temperature which is defined as the average kinetic energy of its molecules. If it is a fluid, those molecules are really moving, and the temperature is primarily the kinetic energy of motion of those molecules, although some texts will explain it as temperature is the number of collisions per second between the molecules. The molecules, as they move around, are hitting each other. And the number of collisions per second, even though they're perfectly balanced collisions with no loss of energy, are considered the temperature. So the velocity, 1/2 mv², the velocity, that's energy, average energy, that's temperature, or the number of times they hit each other. I can call that temperature. In the vacuum of space, there is no fluid my thermometer bulb is in contact with. Now all that's happening is the solar radiation is hitting the bulb of my thermometer. The bulb of my thermometer has a certain albedo. It's got a certain A to E index, a absorptivity to emissivity index. So depending on the angle that the sun is shining on it, and depending on how many miles I am away from the sun, it will settle on some particular temperature because of its, literally, its color. The color that I paint the bulb will determine what temperature it goes to. I'm determining the albedo of the bulb of the thermometer. So that's what's fixing the temperature, and now I'm measuring the temperature of the paint that I put on the bulb, which is really its color, and how well it absorbs solar energy. So a thermometer in free space is a peculiar thing. If I have a perfect mirror, a parabolic mirror, and I put the thermometer at the focal point of the mirror, and I aim the mirror at the coldest point of space, even though the back of the mirror is looking at the sun, the front of the mirror and the focal point and the thermometer are now focused on the coldest point of space. In theory, that thermometer will go down to 3 degrees Kelvin, the background, 2.97 degrees Kelvin, the background temperature of space. So a thermometer in space, when there's no material or a fluid around it, becomes a little bit difficult to define. That's the way I see it, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Okay, very good. Let's go back to Wes before we run out of time.
You got it, Wes. I know we haven't told you how a vacuum stores energy. There ain't no clear... that vacuum is going to be confined in a cavity. It's going to be confined into a piece of space that we have defined. It is confined into a piece of space that we have defined. Under those circumstances, I can talk about the stored energy of the vacuum. But if I'm really talking about a chunk of vacuum space where I have put some dotted lines around it, so to speak, but I really haven't enclosed it in any way, Glenn will say that there's no energy there, that energy can flow through it, and only when I put a substance there that the energy hits do I sense the fact that there was energy going through that space. So it looks like energy can propagate through a vacuum, but can the vacuum, when unconfined, contain energy? Maybe the answer is no.
Energy.
What was that again, John?
Dark energy, which they haven't proven positively yet, it's energy in space, in a vacuum.
Yeah, but that word dark energy is just a coined word to try to explain something that ain't explained. All of the stuff out of the perimeter of our observable universe is increasing in velocity at the rate it moves away from us. But nobody has explained that one yet. They think it's a repulsive force, but almost everything in Mother Nature is attractive or nothing. Very little is repulsive. Just a pair of positive charges or a pair of negative charges repel. Up close only. At galactic distances, I don't accept that. I don't think there's any repulsion. I think the so-called dark energy is the perimeter material is being sucked over the hill to the next nearest galaxy, the next nearest universe that we don't see. To think that there's only one universe and we just happen to be in the middle of it is a little bit arrogant. I think there are multiverses.
And it goes on the matrix that they're talking about.
Yeah, did you make some sense out of that Boson article?
Yes, I did. Interesting article. Okay, Dick. 73 and enjoy it. We'll talk soon. Have a great night. Good tomorrow. Talk to you later. KC2WGB.